My name is William Griggs, founder of the Startup Slingshot, a resource that delivers guidance from experienced entrepreneurs and business experts on how to dream, launch, and grow your business. Now, if you're currently running a startup or thinking about launching one and want to increase your chances of success, this is the interview for you. Today, I'm going to be talking with Steve Blank. Steve is a super successful author of Four Steps to the Epiphany, angel investor, professor at Stanford and Berkeley, and a serial entrepreneur having founded 8 companies. On this episode, Steve is going to answer some viewer-submitted questions and share with us some crucial lessons he's learned over the years in an effort to equip you with the knowledge you need to be successful. Enjoy. All right, Steve, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, William. This is the best interview I think I'm ever going to have.
Oh, man, yes. I've seen a lot of them, so we'll see. I'll do my best, and I know you're bringing your A game today, and I teased it in the introduction, but there's a lot of great content about the customer development cycle and a lot of interviews out there with you that I'm planning to put links to in the show notes below this video. But today I want to do something a little bit different. I want you to help some of our viewers increase their specific chance of likelihood of success by answering some of their viewer submitted questions and sharing some of the lessons you've learned through your career. So to start, let's dig into some of these viewer submitted questions. Number one kind of goes back to the basics, and it's from Jason in Kansas. He's saying, you know, there are tons of entrepreneurial resources out there, books, websites, podcasts, and he wants to launch his own startup. He already has what he thinks is a great idea, but he wants to know what to do next. He feels like he's overwhelmed with the resources. What's your advice? Can you simplify the process for what to do next?
You know, one of the great things about entrepreneurship now versus when I started, there were maybe 3 guys you had coffee with once a month who had some information of how the stuff worked. And now, you know, your biggest problem is being not overwhelmed with whose advice, whose site, which book, etc. And so I guess my best advice for an entrepreneur is a couple pieces of advice. One is, at the end of the day, you need to have a consistent worldview. What it is you're doing and why. And by, I mean, a consistent worldview is, unless you have kind of a set of profound beliefs here about we're going to follow this process for this reason and why with these goals, you're going to be jerked around by every blog you read or best advice or advice of the day or the things your buddies are doing. And it's going to drive you crazy because you're not going to have an opinion. If you want to be a successful entrepreneur, you need to have a profound belief in something. Now, where do you get those? That's a different question. There are a set of great resources to kind of follow. You know, I'd be reading Hacker News just to kind of get a sense of things. I have a tab on my blog, steveblank.com, called Startup Tools, which is a link to not only great tools to buy and use, but also a great set of blogs. I also have another tab called Startup Books. I wouldn't suggest reading all of those. In fact, I'd suggest reading a minimal set of those. But at the end of the day, you do need some research so you can get a profound belief. Talk to some friends, read some stuff, and come up with an opinion. Do you want to do customer development and agile? Is it the lean methodology? Is it something else? Do you know all that is BS? We're going to build it ourselves in our dorm, and we're going to launch it, and that's good enough. And I don't care. I'm certainly never going to claim that, for example, customer development is the ultimate answer. I think anybody who's telling you what they have is the answer is probably trying to sell you something and has a hand in your wallet. I don't know if this answers.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. It's kind of going back to the beginning, finding a process that they kind of believe in, like you're saying, and sticking to that and not saying, oh, I'm going to learn from this and implement this. Oh, I'm going back over here. I'm going to implement that.
It'll drive you crazy. And so it really goes back to trying to understand fundamentally what's the purpose of a startup. So that's where I go back to the basics is, you know, everybody has their own definition. So I'll give you Steve's definition because it kind of is actionable and ties in all these other pieces. My definition of a startup is that a startup is a temporary organization designed to search a repeatable and scalable business model. And that sentence is worth parsing because it has some interesting pieces. One is, it's startup is temporary. Gee, it's not about, you know, free food and sodas and bringing your dog to work and working with a great group of people. Eventually, you don't want to do that. The sad part is, you want to be 10,000 people, even though you're starting with a small group. And by the way, if that's not your goal, then your goal isn't what we're calling a startup, at least here in technology cluster land. If your goal is, well, I don't want to be 10,000 people, then you're actually building a small business. Nothing wrong with that, but just understanding you're not building a scalable or even a viable startup. You're building something that could be great income for you and your family, but you're in a different class of companies. And it's, you know, you're clearly an entrepreneur, but building something different. Two is, and so the word temporary is, your goal is not to stay a startup. The next thing is searching. Well, gee, I thought I'm supposed to be building code and I thought I'm supposed to be getting users or revenue. No, not really. You're searching for all of those. And all of those are kind of called your business model. Business model is all the pieces that make up a company that help you generate value and get revenue for your company. I happen to use Alexander Osterwalder's Business Model Canvas. There's a great book called Business Model Generation that helps you think about what a business model is. And your goal is to find one that's repeatable and scalable. That is, that you, you know, put N dollars in, for example, in SEO, and you get, you know, 2N number of customers out the other end.
Gotcha.
The process. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense to kind of understand how you're defining it and what you're, right, and which direction. Go ahead.
Right. And so once you've got that basic definition, then all of a sudden, okay, if I believe in a business model, I ought to go look up what one is. Oh, a search. Well, how do you search for one? Oh, that's what customer development is. That's the process for getting out of the building, physically and virtually, of searching for a business model. Oh, my goal is not to just write the product or physically build it. It's actually to get customers and channel partners and revenue. And oh, I understand. Now there are other pieces. By the way, that's one path. You can pick your own path. No, my goal is to code stuff and sell it. And I don't need no damn process because I'm smart. Okay, go do that. Then the nice part about doing a startup is there are no laws. There's no government intervention that's going to tell you this is the right way to do it. So some of us have decided to provide help, but you don't have to take it. I don't really care. I'm retired.
Well, what's interesting is that actually factors into the question we got from Jared in Florida, who said people keep telling him to read Four Steps to the Epiphany, Lean Startup, Business Model Generation, and he says he has all three books, but he doesn't really know where to begin. So we're starting to kind of answer that question in terms of how they play in, but can you kind of give them more of an overview of how they connect with each other?
Well, first of all, who is it, Jeremy?
Jared.
Jared. Well, Jared hasn't failed yet. So after you fail miserably once, all of a sudden these books become a lot more important to you. Because right now, if you actually haven't done a startup before, all this advice is kind of like learning the Fahrenheit to Celsius conversion table. You know, it's kind of nice and it's interesting, but it's really not relevant to you until, like, you've screwed up a couple of years of your life and, you know, lost some other people's money. If you're very smart, you figure it out the first time. It took me actually a lot longer. Here's what we, so this ties back to the definition of a startup, temporary organization designed to search for a scalable and repeatable business model. It goes back even further. For the last 50 years in Silicon Valley, entrepreneurs and their investors got startups wrong. We used to think that startups were smaller versions of large companies, which meant large companies write business plans, you go write a business plan. Large companies hire a head of sales and marketing and biz dev, what? Of course you need that. And what we never understood was the distinction was large companies are executing, or companies, period, known business models. And so what they're doing is process-oriented, product management and engineering-driven things based on a series of knowns. But startups are all about solving for unknowns. And so what you're really doing is search. Even though you think it might be about coding and features, not really, because at the end of the day, it assumes if you think it's all about coding and all I need to do is finish the product and then save room in my little garage for where I'm going to put the bags of money, I don't know what universe you're living in, but it never works that way, or only in the movies.
Right. That's a good piece to drive home to the viewers of how it's actually the difference between the startup and the big business, and the difference in process is they each take.
it's the difference between search and execution. And so one of the biggest things that founders get wrong is thinking that their vision and passion is a substitute for customer and market knowledge. And so the line I've been teaching for even when I was an entrepreneur doing 8 startups is, there are no facts inside your building, so get the hell out. I mean, you know, as smart as, and in fact, the smarter the entrepreneur, the harder this problem is because if you think you're a genius, you can't learn from everybody. And everybody says, well, I'm Steve Jobs. You know, he never got out, you know, like, okay, well, if you do think you're Steve Jobs, you know, congratulations. Why don't we just stand back and we'll set our watch and see if that's the case. Now, the odds are you're not Steve Jobs. And the odds are, while you're smart, you're not that smart. Because unless you're going to be buying or using your own products, and that's your entire customer base, you don't know jack. And the facts are actually outside. What are the facts? Who are the customers? You know, what's their segments? What are their age? You know, what's the channel of distribution? How are you going to get, keep and grow customers? How are you going to do SEO or SEM or anything else appear on the web? How do you acquire and activate? What's your revenue strategy versus what are your pricing tactics? Do you need partners? While you could write all those down and put them in a plan, I will guarantee you the safest bet on the planet is betting that you're wrong.
Gotcha. So documenting and understanding the difference between big business and startup is search versus execution, and then getting out of the building to tell to figure out whether or not the words on the paper that you have are true or false.
Right. And in fact, how we're going to do it, use the business model canvas to organize these words on the paper, we're going to call them hypotheses. Actually, we call them hypotheses when I teach in universities because they pay a lot of money. Outside of universities, they're called guesses. And so we're going to organize these guesses along a business model rather than a business plan. And then we're going to use customer development and agile methodology to quickly iterate and test problem and solution. So the first thing you want to do is, on a big idea level, is implicitly in anything you're building, you believe there's a problem or need that someone other than you shares. Well, why don't you get out and convince yourself that that's the case? Oh, Steve, I know that this is a real problem, or people will really want, well, how do you know? Well, I asked my roommate. Well, not really. So first of all, get out and test the problem. And you don't do that by talking. You do that with either, you know, is there a website that you could kind of get people interested in as we solve this problem? Get them to click the red button if they agree. The next thing is can you get them to agree that your solution, not your features, not all the UI, not whatever, but just the general thing you want to solve, solves their problem or need. And so first of all, it's testing the problem, next it's testing the solution. And this is pretty, we document this for both web mobile startups and physical startups in the new book, The Startup Owner's Manual, which goes through a fairly intensive step-by-step guide on how to do this.
Yeah, so is it starting off with the idea, then try to build out your business model canvas, then going on the customer development, and then coming back to the business model canvas?
Yes. So, you know, Eric Ries, who kind of the Johnny Appleseed, that is someone who's done a spectacular job of popularizing the startup movement, was the best student I ever had in my class. You know, I sat on his board and funded his first company. And Eric, when he sat through the customer development class, said, gee, that little arrow you have is that feedback loop deserves a name. And he called it the pivot, which I think was the most brilliant thing that was ever done, is he actually gave name to something we had been talking about, but just never actually articulated as well as he did. I define the pivot as a substantive change to one or more of the business model canvas components. By substantive, I mean, did you just get out of the building and figure out that your customers are no longer 18 to 25-year-old boys, but are housewives, 45 to 55, that's a substantive change in customer segment. That's a pivot. Did you figure out that your pricing shouldn't be freemium, but should be subscription? That's a pivot. Did you figure out that they don't like your top 4 features, but it was the bottom 3? Pivot. But did you just change pricing from $4.99 to $14.99? That's an iteration. still the same revenue model. The pricing's kind of changed. And again, it's a little subjective, but at the end of the day, here's the big insight. Startups, now we now know, go from pivot to pivot. In the old days, if you didn't match the plan with execution, we fired you. Now we fire the plan. I mean, that's really an interesting, that is, we now know that no startup executes per plan, but we just had a static document. So we're tossing out the business plan and replacing it with something a lot more agile. And my blog post today on steveblank.com, search versus execute, kind of takes you through all these steps about what's different and why. When are we searching and when are we executing?
Makes a lot of sense. So to Jared out there, it's kind of this process of combining the business model that kind of documents your hypotheses or your assumptions, and then going out using the customer development method to test those, and iterating on top of that, maybe pivoting, maybe staying the course.
Yeah.
Gotcha. The next question comes from a guy named Kyle in DC, and it's more around advice. And he was wondering if you see one mistake that entrepreneurs continue to repeat. If so, what is it, and what would you recommend they do differently?
You know, the biggest mistake is thinking that, you know, because I read Eric's book or my book or the blog, and I'm using the words, that you can now go build the product. And I don't mean don't start iterating, but customer development is really hard. It's hard. If you think it's easy, then you're really not doing it. I think the biggest mistake is kind of giving lip service, but not quite understanding what it really means to get out there and get your teeth kicked in. Let me just talk about physical products rather than web for a second. I teach something called the Lean Launchpad class at Stanford, which is basically think of it as an incubator in a classroom. In 8 weeks, students who are taking a full course load, on average, speak to 100 customers face-to-face. In 8 weeks. Now, if you had a full-time job, you know, this was your full-time thing, I would expect you to double or triple of that. Now, if you're not doing that, you know, in your startup, then you really don't understand what customer development is. And so I think the biggest mistake is, well, I spoke to 3 people this week and I did a WebMonkey survey. Well, you know, excuse me, doing a survey online without taking some percentage of them in your office or watching them work or interviewing a person is just meaningless. So the answer is underestimating how hard this is.
Gotcha. So they're basically consuming the information, assuming that they understand, and then putting out a survey. They're doing minimal work that they feel like suffices, but you're saying this is hard stuff, 300 plus people minimum, bring them in the office, talk to them, coffee shops. They'll just take the easy way out.
You need to be a voracious, you know, customer discovery animal. And so that's usually the first step in getting out of the building. The second step, though, is that what I found is that once I started doing this is, okay, we've got lots of data. And then people think, oh, I get it. I add up what everybody said, and then I'll go do what they say. And, you know, this brings up my other point of this is why accountants don't run startups. The idea is it's not a quantification. This is not quantitative analysis. You're not adding up whether 47 people said yes and 3 said no, because the 47 people might have said yes to the 1099 package, but 3 said, you know, you're just building this wrong. You got to sell this as $1 million piece of enterprise software. And you kind of laughed and walked out on them. By the way, I've been there. Until you finally realize, wait a minute, what did those guys say again? And you go back. And so you're not just, so you think about what you're doing outside the building. One is you're getting out, but two is you're designing experiments to test a series of hypotheses. And what experiments? Something as simple as, you know, I'm going to run an SEO test and, you know, I think I should get 20 activations, but I only got 2. Great. So the first level is, well, I got the data, Steve. No. What I want you to do is get insight from the data. What does that mean? Was it the wrong target or was your web page wrong? I mean, so... And in the physical world, you even get more insight. By the way, my favorite question getting out of the building and interviewing somebody personally is we might have a 10 or 20 or half hour discussion. My last question is always, so what should have I asked you? And sometimes that conversation will go on for another half hour. We'll go to dinner. Oh, wow, you actually care. Does this help?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think that's, again, hitting on something that people take for granted. They think of it and they think they understand it and they're looking for a yes or no. But you're saying it's not really so much a yes or no. It's more the insight from the feedback. And it's also not a, I want this feature, I want this feature, I want this feature. So you're going to build it all. Instead, it's insight gleaned from that.
People look at how Zynga optimizes their games and say, well, Steve, see, it's all about the data. What are you talking about? It's nothing about, you know, insight or whatever. They kind of forget that Zynga optimizing their games is not how they built their business. Their business was, you know, like Mark Pincus, actually having insight about, let me test this idea, let me talk to these people, testing, trying, failing. The tweaking is now the execution mode. What they miss is the beginning of the conversation, which was the search mode, just trying to figure out what is a business model. Is it Facebook? Is it some other platform, etc.? And forgetting about what the first year looked like and using that with the execution part of the company.
That's a good point to drive home. That's definitely a misconception and a confusion point for many of the people that watch this show. It's the search versus looking at an established company and saying, hey, they're iterating. They're just looking A-B testing. That's all I need to do. It's more the insight you glean from the customer development during the search phase.
You know, the point is, you should be so lucky to have that problem of iteration, right? It's how do you get there is the question.
Yeah, kind of how do you even start before you need to start A-B testing and doing all the things that Zynga or some other more established companies do to optimize.
Right. Or the other fallacy is, you know, the Steve Jobs fallacy. Oh, I don't need to take... Listen, I am so smart. I sit in a light-aligned room in a Lotus Zen position, you know, and stuff just comes to me. Which, by the way, even for Steve Jobs, who was probably the best in the business about this, was just wrong. I live about a mile from the Palo Alto Apple store and in the other direction, so does Steve Jobs. And when he was healthy, I'd say about once a month, I'd walk in there or walk by there. There he would be in the store. Now, it didn't strike me for years. It just never struck me that said, wait a minute, Steve Jobs, I bet you we could get a computer delivered to his house. What the hell was he doing in the store? Well, now, of course, it's easy to understand. You know, he was just watching. He wanted to see what people bought and what people whatever. And then the other thing he used to do was that he used to answer a customer email about once a month with something cryptic. You know, yes, no, or, you know, go shove it up here, whatever.
Right.
And what you never understood was he just reading one email a month? I doubt it.
Right.
This guy was wired in completely. That doesn't take away from, he was one of the rare people who had the world's best intersection of art and science, probably as good as Disney, the original Sony founder, Edward Land, I think are all kind of the models of him rather than Bill Gates or Michael Dell, etc. But it wasn't that he was cut off from all customer input. That's the PR spin that made him look even more, you know, genius-like, not to take away from the fact that he was.
Right.
Sorry about the digression.
No, it makes a lot of sense. It's I've heard other people say it's kind of dangerous to read that book because you want to be like Steve. You want to emulate what you think made him successful, whether it was being a jerk to people or not listening to feedback. But like you're saying, if you look at the Apple Store is the antithesis, the opposite of every other store, not because he just made it up. It was because he looked at other stores and said, that store sucks for these reasons, and we're going to make this store awesome for these reasons.
So for all your viewers who want to be like Steve Jobs and ignore all this stuff, more power to you. But the people who actually do pay attention to this stuff, I predict, will kick your butt from here to Sunday. Because the odds are you're not Steve Jobs.
Right.
And hopefully the people working for you discover that quickly.
Gotcha, yeah. The next question is from Andrew from here in Nashville. And he wants to know if you have any tips for startups that are brand new and pursuing a B2B market, specifically around how to get the attention of larger customers and potential partners.
Yeah, you know, my last company, Epiphany, sold to enterprise software to large corporations. And one of the things I learned, particularly in the B2B market, is that startups confuse themselves early on with that all customers on day one are the same. And that's a real mistake, because the people who will typically buy from a startup on day one are crazy people, just like you. I call them early evangelists, early adopters, internal evangelists. That is, if you think about dealing with a large corporation, why on earth would a large company bet on 2 or 20 guys in a garage, you know, versus all these other choices? Well, we have something better, it's great, it's insight. Any rational person is going to say, come back in a year or two when you have customers. And of course, you're going, no, but I want you to be that customer. How do I get one? And the insight is, it turns out that throughout corporate America in the U.S., are people just as crazy as you are and just as visionary, but with a different personal risk profile. They're not betting their jobs or their mortgage, but they are just as visionary. And what your job is to find those people. And what they're looking for at the end of the day is a competitive advantage. And what they want is some new technology to help them kind of win in, you know, and typically you find these not in the market leaders, but in the numbers 2, 3, or 4 in the marketplace who are looking, who are heading this direction. Don't call on anybody heading this direction. You want to look for these people. And the interesting characteristic is as follows. They have a problem. That is, they, their company, and they're in charge of solving it. They know they have a problem. Okay? They've been looking actively for a solution. 4 is, it's so important to them, they've tried to cobble together a solution out of piece parts themselves. And 5 is, they have or can acquire a budget. These are 1 out of 20 people in the enterprise. So now all of a sudden you have a roadmap. It's okay to be thrown out 19 times because 18 of those people are going to buy from you in 2 to 3 years. You're looking for those people who meet these criteria that says, yes, your solution is exactly what it, boy, I've been cobbling this together. Look, let's work together. They become your internal salesperson. Does this make sense?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
And by the way, if you can't find any, it's a sign that it doesn't get better over time.
So that's interesting feedback for Andrew here in Nashville, which is finding someone that maybe not in the top spot because their risk profile is probably lower. They're more fearful of, depending on the company and the profile of that company, but they might be more fearful of losing market share than actually trying to gain additional market share.
Actually, yes, sometimes, but most of the time, being number one gives you an arrogance that says you're always going to be number one. We don't need anything from anybody else. Being number two, it's pretty clear that you'd like to be number one.
Gotcha, that makes a lot of sense. That's definitely actionable feedback. Looking for that person that's looking for the competitive advantage to try to leapfrog their competition. Like you're saying, it's a numbers game because you're going to get 1 out of 20 now, but in a few years, once you have some more traction, you're going to get the other 15 or out of 20.
And this is something that I talk about in some detail in the Startup Owner's Manual about that step and that hierarchy and how to find them and how to work with them, etc. I call them early evangelists.
Gotcha. The last question we have in this section is, I don't actually have the name of this question, but this person says they want to be an entrepreneur and they want to know your advice on whether they should pursue an MBA or not.
You know, I teach both in the engineering school and in 2 business schools. And, the question really is what do you want to do with your life? Certainly an MBA gives you a base that you're not going to get on the street. Let's just remember that the MBA is only about 100 years old as a degree. Harvard issued the first one or put together the first MBA class in 1908. They basically concatenated 300 years of business history and basically said that the country could use a cohort of Masters of Business Administration, not business startups, but business administration. And the timing was perfect. The U.S. was going from an agrarian economy to an industrial economy. And they became the shock troops for the American century. But let's be clear, the classic MBA curriculum was about teaching a set of individuals to become execution and administration managers. And while today entrepreneurship courses have blossomed in universities, essentially what you're going to learn as an MBA, except for maybe your entrepreneurship electives, is about execution. you know, operations, strategy, management, leadership, HR, you know, financing, finance, accounting, etc., globalization, all very important, but all mostly oriented, again, except for your electives, depending where you go to school, about execution. So just understand, is that worth your 2 years in school? Now, if you ever decide you don't want to be an entrepreneur, then, boy, an MBA is a great ticket to a great job in major corporations. Does that help?
Gotcha. Yeah. But what about specific universities that may have a maybe lean towards more entrepreneurial focus, maybe even, you know, Stanford or Babson?
Okay. So all of those schools have great reputations of, and others of, you know, UC Berkeley, Columbia, Babson, Stanford, etc., all being entrepreneurial oriented. But at the end of the day, you really need to figure out where it is you're going. Because at the end of the day, the MBA curriculum is not designed to graduate founders for search. It's just not. You could take those classes and you could decide that that's your curriculum. But really, if you think about what they exist for, it's to graduate leaders for corporate America, and rightly so. And if you want to be entrepreneurial inside those corporations, there are classes to do that. So it really is an interesting trade-off of how to spend your time.
Yeah, and this is a two-part question. Had you said no, then we wouldn't have gotten the second part. The second part they want to know is, if yes, so you've kind of given them the option, what do they want to specialize in? Where's their life? Where do they want to take with their career? Where they want to take their career? Their next question is, how do they get into a top program like a Stanford or a Berkeley, and how do they stand out?
You know, I'll pass on that one. I'm not in the admissions.
Oh, come on, you got no insight?
No insight.
Okay, fine. Let's take that disappointing transition, and we'll go to the next section of the interview, which is all about lessons that you've specifically learned. So the first question is, other than kind of what we've covered here, what other advice do you kind of regularly give entrepreneurs?
You know, let's in fact riff off of that MBA question. One of the classes I taught is a joint MBA, executive MBA from Berkeley, Columbia. I won't name names, but almost every year I get students coming to me at the end of graduation for advice. Professor Blank, you know, I got a couple job offers. Can you help me figure? Sure. You know, but by now I kind of know what are the choices? Oh, me and a couple of roommates, you know, our class project, we're really excited. We're thinking about doing a startup. Oh, that's exciting. Okay. Well, what's the other choice? Well, I got this great offer from McKinsey. And then I stopped them and said, and I usually say, you've already decided. And they go, what? What do you mean? You haven't heard the... No. You've already decided. And the reason why is startups are not a job choice. They're not. McKinsey is a job choice, which is a great, by the way, great career choice. Bain or anybody else, or that's a great choice. Startups, you shouldn't be doing because your roommates are doing it and it is now cool. That is the worst possible reason to do a startup, certainly to found one. If being cool and everybody's doing it is on that list, either implicitly or explicitly, you are going to fail miserably. Startups are a calling. They're a passion. If this is something that you can't sleep at night because you want to write down your ideas or code someone, then you kind of maybe have the bug. Because at the end of the day, founders of startups, they're not engineers or MBAs. The closest analogy that we have in our society is they're actually artists. They see and hear things that no one else does. And they're always aiming for that future vision out there. And they're driven. And they're not only so driven, they could drive others and convince others. And if that's not who you are, you want to just, like, go take some other job or be an early employee or whatever. But founder, you know, you hear the word resilience and you hear the word whatever. But to me, founders are artists. Because the choices you're going to be making are not cut and dry, right? I talked about insight and I talked about, you know, it's about pattern recognition. It's about other things other than I'm the world's best engineer or best MBA or something else.
Gotcha. It makes a lot of sense. So you're saying, you know, if you have that idea, like for instance, the person you were talking about, if they were so passionate about that idea, it wouldn't be a choice. It would be, yes, we're going for it.
Right. My career, I did 8 startups in 21 years before I started teaching. know, I never, at least for the first five startups, I couldn't wait to get up in the morning and go to work. In fact, there were a number of years. I remember driving down Highway 101 in Silicon Valley, thinking that maybe this was the day they were going to find out I would actually pay to work in these companies. Because I loved it. And if your job isn't, I can't wait to get to work, then go get a job in a big company, because, you know, that's what, by the way, that's what normal people do. You know, if you don't say that you're a little twisted and passionate, you don't fit into this entrepreneurship category. Or you should be an employee of an early stage venture. And again, the category I'm talking about are the founders, who are crazy enough to, you know, start in someone's living room with nothing more than an idea and a vision that we're going to take over the world.
Gotcha. What other piece of advice do you find yourself regularly giving either your students or entrepreneurs you talk with?
You don't know it. By you don't know enough isn't that you're not smart enough or that your product isn't coming along well, but you really don't have a clue about your business. And you know, this is just the way I used to screw up is it was all about the features. And when I was confused, I added more features. And if I was still confused, I'd look at the competitors' features and add those. And, you know, pretty soon it was all about the product. But in fact, that's exactly what it's not about. The product is just a piece of what you have. And I go back to this idea called the business model again. You know, customers and channel and pricing and distribution and whatever, that's what it's about. And so when I say you don't know enough, you know, when I was an entrepreneur, never even had a language for this. We always used to say, well, I think it's a marketing problem. Never quite understanding that, no, it's nothing about marketing. It's a business strategy problem. And usually the problem is, you know, you don't have a business strategy. You keep thinking it's about features. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. What about someone out there that, you know, they're super passionate about this idea? Do you have any advice or encouragement for someone that's going through this customer development cycle and they're facing an uphill climb?
Keep climbing. So, you know, when I address a room full of entrepreneurs, a couple hundred, I remind them that in 10 years, one of them is going to make $100 million. And I say, look around. Everybody look around. Because most of you will be better off working at Walmart. And they all kind of laugh, ha, ha, ha. And then I go, yeah, but hopefully all of you are feeling sorry for the poor SOBs next to you because you think you're going to be the one making the $100 million. If that's not you, then give up now and, again, take a regular job. Entrepreneurship is about passion, drive, and vision. And this whole customer development, lean and agile and whatever process is just a way for you to reduce those risks. But if you don't have the ability to, you know, when you're smacked down, to stand back up, learn from it, and keep going, you're in the wrong job. And it doesn't mean there's anything wrong with you. Again, this is what abnormal people do. People who are gluttons for punishment with a vision and a passion for seeing something through, but capable of listening and learning at the same time. It is a rare skill. And it might be that you decide, you know what, I don't want to be the founder. I want to work for somebody who's already raised money, and I'll be employee 10 rather than
It also makes sense for the viewers out there to hear that, to know, even if they might be consuming a lot of books or seeing a lot of podcasts that have the entrepreneurs putting their best face forward, telling everybody, yeah, we're crushing it, we're doing great, that in reality, behind the closed doors, they hit some of these same, you know, holes and some had to, you know, leap over the same problems that you're having to face.
Well, you know, the sad part is that most startups fail, right? It's a big idea. Most startups fail. The whole notion of the customer development process and lean and everything else is all we're trying to do is reduce infant mortality from stopping you from doing some of the stupid things we now know entrepreneurs do. Build product without customers, you know, get customers without understanding pricing. All this stuff is to reduce risk. And I can tell you for sure, across a portfolio, we actually now know it does reduce risk. Does it guarantee that you're going to become Facebook? Absolutely not. And by the way, anybody telling you follow this method and you could become Groupon or Facebook or someone else is just lying through their teeth. And I don't mean on purpose, but we can guarantee that if you follow some kind of methodology and think through what you're doing, your odds of running out of cash early because you hired 20 people before you thought about X, Y, and Z, we're just not going to let you do that.
Gotcha. That's a good point to drive home. And before we kind of end this interview, are there any entrepreneurs out there that you really admire that we should kind of look towards for inspiration or even more information?
Well, you know, I think there's a whole list of entrepreneurs in the web world, you know, who have kind of got big and have done great, etc. You know, every once in a while you run into somebody in the corporate world who you give the best compliment of, gee, you could be the CEO of any startup I've ever seen. And of course, they're running a $100 million division. My best one is a guy at General Electric, of all places, who basically was given a charter to get GE into the clean energy business with a new revolutionary battery. And the story went is that the CEO of GE, Jeff Immelt, said, here, take $100 million, take this technology, you know, dig a hole in the ground, build a factory, and we want to have a $1 billion business. And so the guy was about to go do that, and he said, you know, I've been at GE for a decade or so, and most of my other businesses, we just sell to existing customers. I was about to put the shovel on the ground, and I realized we don't have any customers. We didn't even know who these are. And so he went back to Immelt and said, no, you could either fire me or take your $100 million back, but I think before we built the factory, we ought to figure out who this new customer segment is. And so they spent the last 2 years trying to figure out who would buy these high-temperature sodium batteries. And then it was only after they did that they broke ground, and now the factory is sold out. So this guy's name is Prescott Logan. And so for me, kind of the best hero that kind of crosses entrepreneurship, not only on an individual scale and a web startup scale, but actually is making this happen in large corporations, is Prescott Logan at GE. And the other ones I'll just throw out is we've been teaching these classes now for the National Science Foundation. The U.S. government has kind of said, you know, we should figure out how to take our best researchers who want to commercialize their stuff and see if we could teach them how to become entrepreneurs, the ones who volunteer to do that. And so instead of, 20-year-olds with hoodies and flip-flops, we're talking about 45-year-old average age professors with tenure with, you know, labs. Yet the surprise was we made them get out of the building as fast or faster than I've been ever able to do with my Stanford and Berkeley students. So for me, it was just kind of nice as, yes, I spend a lot of time with Silicon Valley startups, but now I spend time with corporate startups and startups in hardware and software and labs and whatever. And it turns out that this methodology is actually quite teachable across a broad range, which, by the way, I just want to leave your audience with something, an interesting observation, is I think that, you know, 10 years ago even, Silicon Valley was, and maybe Boston or New York, that's where entrepreneurship happened, and it was kind of a closed culture. We're really seeing the transformation of innovation and entrepreneurship, and the integration all across the U.S. in a way that I think, for a time, will be U.S.-centric, and will transform the way businesses emerge, get bought, etc. We are at the beginning of something really exciting. And I think all your viewers are just part of a new revolution for how to do business. So welcome, you know, welcome to the revolution, guys.
Yeah, no, it's definitely an exciting time. I guess to wrap it up, what have I missed? Is there any one piece of advice you want to leave in addition, leave the viewers of this video?
No, I'll leave with the advice that I started with. You know, there are lots of gurus in the business. Some people claim I'm Eric, you know, whatever. I think at least most of us would say there's an old Buddhist koan which says when you see the Buddha in the street, kill him. At the end of the day, you don't want to follow anybody. You want to follow you. And so your job is to figure out which pieces of this actually give you a philosophy that you're not following me. You're following you, and that just takes some integration and time, and that's when I think you'll actually get to the next level. So I thank you for your time.
Yeah, I was going to say, how can people follow you online, but instead I'll say, how can people connect with you online?
I write a blog at www.steveblank.com. And there are links to all my slides and tools and blogs. I wrote two books, one called The Four Steps to the Epiphany, which kind of launched, I guess, the lean startup movement, and then a later one called The Startup Owner's Manual, which is a step-by-step guide for either software or hardware startups who want to know how to build a early-stage venture.
Yeah, definitely. I'll put the links in the show notes below the video to the books, to the blog, and to some other interviews. I really appreciate your time. This has been a great interview.
Great. Thank you, and thanks for your time.
All right. Thanks for watching.